Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured. Today, I am super excited to have with me Zoe Peden. Zoe is the quintessential operator turned investor, but she's doing it in a way that creates value beyond just the returns. Zoe was co-founder of MyChoicePad, an award-winning language and communication development software for people with learning disabilities, which is used by over 120,000 people. 10 years in and beyond MyChoicePad, Zoe has been heavily immersed in the world of impact, having sat on the investment committee for Unlimited, the social accelerator. She's a jury panel member at the European Innovation Council Accelerator and a principal at Ananda Impact Ventures, a technology-focused pan-European impact venture fund with a focus at Seed Plus and Series A. Welcome, Zoe.
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me on.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. So let's jump straight in. The story behind how you launched MyChoicePad is really special, including a bit of a diversion and detour to New York to purchase an iPad, I understand. Can you talk us through how you got into entrepreneurship and the journey that led you to building your own business?
Yeah, sure. Gosh, it feels quite some time ago now, but about 12 years ago, I started to work at a charity called the Macketon Charity. Prior to that, I'd spent 10 years building electronic products, as they called them then, but essentially they were websites and CD-ROMs and portals, as we used to call them. And then I went to work at a charity as a senior manager. I wanted to hone my business skills after being in product for so long. And this charity had a language program of sign language and symbols, and that actually helped people with learning disabilities to communicate. And it was something that had been clinically proven, lots of clinical trials over 30 years, but it was in print format and VHS video. So extremely successful, but not digitized in any sense. And if you look back at many of the businesses around 2008, 2009, a lot of them were around digitizing existing print products and services. So we all went through this stage of digitization. And that's what I did. I saw an opportunity. I'd built something with my co-founder on a mobile app, so on the iPhone first. But when I took it to Vecta, which was the old education conference that was around then, and I met some head teachers, some government people, I showed them the phone, so obviously a bit smaller than this size, and this looked at it, I went, that'll end up in the toilet with our kids, it's too small a device, it's going to get thrown, it's going to get destroyed, it's too small, and many of the people with dexterity issues or with visual impairments won't be able to see, it's too small. So we were like, okay, so it's not quite right yet. And then I think it was February 2010, Steve Jobs announced the iPad. So at one of the special, Apple showcase days, and I was sat on the sofa, I think it was a Friday night, and a glass of wine in my hand, and my co-founder just, got in touch and said, listen, will you take a look at this and look at Steve Jobs and the iPad? And I saw the size of his hand compared to the iPad, and I thought, this is big enough. This device is big enough. This is it. So at that point, I kind of knew this is what I wanted to do, that there was, there was a market there. There was already over 100,000 people using this language program called Macketon across the UK. And I knew how to get to them all because I had a route to market through the charity. But I didn't have an iPad. So, and I wanted to get ahead of everyone else in case, because when you set up your own business, you're always worried that someone else is going to have the same idea as you. It doesn't work like that. It's all on the execution. But at the time, you think that you want to be first because someone else will get there before you. So we booked a flight to New York. It was my very first time going to New York. We got on there and we queued up at Fifth Avenue to get one iPad. That's all we could afford at the time. And there were people in that queue. It was quite a frenzy going, how many are you getting? And I'm here and I'm getting five. And I'm like, oh, I'm from London. I'm getting one. But it was quite exciting to be involved in it. And I've got this picture of me in the New York hotel with me kissing the iPad that we put on, one of our first blogs on the website when we built MyChoicePad. But, it was an exciting beginning. and then coming back with it, we managed to get, you know, a heads up on a lot of other people building an iPad app. And we were one of the first ones out, and we released My Choice Pad. It took about 8 months in prototype, worked with lots of schools, worked with lots of families. And one of the things that I'm actually quite proud of, I'm proud of lots of things, but I realized that video was going to be really powerful. And I started filming everything and creating stories through video. So I guess, yeah, 11 years ago, I was filming for YouTube and creating and editing these stories. And this was so, so powerful. Everyone knows it now. But at that time, no one was telling stories like this. You know, the difference that this product was making to the children's lives, and they were involved in the trial. And as soon as, you know, that we released in 2011, just set off these YouTube things and everybody was just watching, and it was just selling itself from YouTube. Everyone knows that now. It's a simple playbook, but 11 years ago, it wasn't.
Yeah, but I mean, there's something to be said for first mover advantage. I think you bring a whole new kind of flavor to that game. I mean, so much to kind of unpack there. The first thing that struck me, you talked about effectively what you had looked at doing was the digitization of content, right? Which was probably EdTech 1.0, I think, back in, as you say, 2010 and thereafter. And obviously that led to the kind of MOOCs and all of those sort of things within the EdTech framework, which now is moving on from purely the digitization of content, but also the delivery and changes of mechanisms. So you were quite a pioneer, effectively.
Fell into being a pioneer. Yes, normally is how it works, yeah.
That's the best way to get into things, I think. And it's very interesting, as you say, you know, sometimes it's not about being first, it's about doing it well. And execution, as you say, is super important. But actually, there were quite a few struggles getting funding for my Choice Pad, I think, initially. And your first breakthrough was from somewhere which I think most of our listeners may never have even heard of before. How different is it, or was it, pitching for grant funding from somewhere like Unlimited versus, you know, a VC fund?
Well, to be honest, at the time I was pitching for Unlimited, I'd never pitched anywhere else. So I didn't have that knowledge. I think I started to pitch once we were 7 weeks old in the App Store. So I'd been working on it for just over a year, and we'd been live 7 weeks. And I'd been watching Seed Camp 2010. I think it was the first UK Seed Camp. So there were videos. They posted videos of that. So I watched how they pitched. And I, you know, from about 2008, 2009, I was interested in tech startups, reading TechCrunch, seeing what was happening in the States, you know, hearing about Silicon Roundabout was just forming. There was only Seed Camp. I think there was what used to be, there was one other one, Spring Accelerator or something like that it was called. There was nothing else, absolutely nothing else. So everything was just like Seed Camp. So watching those videos, I saw that you could, you know, turn up at events, and I practiced my pitch basically with a hairbrush and in the mirror, really old fashioned. And then I went to some of the events, traveled into London. I was living in the suburbs at the time. And I went to two or three events and met my first person who called themselves an angel investor. That was good to get to know who they were. I felt really special when they spoke to me. It was the first person I've met like that, still in touch with him now. And after about three events, I decided that I was going to pitch at one of these. And it was this week in startups. So we were doing it virtually. And I actually became the joint winner. It was really, really high profile twist this week in startups. Winning that helped me get my confidence. And then I went to a tech hub product, like a demonstration. They didn't let you pitch. And that got me, you know, it was really, really good with Mike Butcher, was doing that one. So that was right at the beginning of 2011. And he told me how to hold the mic. He said, like a rock star, because I was holding it too far away from me. I was so nervous. But afterwards, so many people came up to me. And then I did one other one called Tech Pitch 4.5. And in the audience of this one, and I won that one too, was somebody from Unlimited. So by that point, I think I'd done three and did really well on each three. It was like week after week. You know, we're only talking weeks here, because that's how founders work. It's from week to week. And then they contacted me by email and said, we've got a competition that we're running called Big Venture Challenge. It's the first time we've run it. And we don't have anyone like you so far that submitted. The deadline's in 48 hours. And I looked at this massive long form, and it needed cash flow forecast for the next 3 years. you know, I was 7 weeks old. And I just said, I don't have all this. And he says, don't worry, don't fill it in. just get the submission in. We'll deal with it later. And I was like, oh, fine. And I did it. Then it was quite stressful filling the rest in. And then they called me up and I went through all the different rounds. And at the time I was like pinching myself thinking, wow, what's happening here? And yeah, I got through all the different rounds. And the final round was quite harrowing, actually. It had quite a few very successful entrepreneurs, including one of the founders of Pret A Manger on there. I think his name's Sinclair. And some of the chair of Unlimited. And it was a big, like, 12 or 13 people that you had to pitch to in the finals. And getting through all that, you really, really want it, because it was, I think it was £25,000 grant and match funding of up to £100,000 if you could bring in angel money, and a 3-year support program too. So quite massive. So I really, really wanted it by that point. And it was only a matter of, I think we're talking about a 2-month time period from beginning to end here. It was very quick. And all the tech went down. They couldn't show it on the screen as soon as I got there. So then I had to pitch to 12 people from my laptop, which isn't great because they can't really see. And then I also did the live demo on the iPad as well. And I was so stressed and nervous that when some of them started to dig into me about my plans to expand into the US, which I think were a little bit too ambitious, it was true. But, you know, I was right at the beginning. They were a little bit harsh with me. And I came out of there shaking. I did my best of what I could do in the circumstances. And I came out shaking and went and met a friend. And I was in tears afterwards just because I thought I messed it up, because one of them really went for me. And I just took it all so personally. It's very hard when you've worked on and you want something so much and it becomes very personal. And I thought, I've lost it. And I remember being in my bed, actually, I think a few days later, and I got a phone call and it was Unlimited. And they said, oh, so you're sitting down? I said, well, actually, I'm in bed. And they said, you're through. You've won. You're one of the winners. And I can just remember the feeling like this was such a step change in my life. This totally changed so many things. At that point, I was wondering how I was going to pay the rent where I was living at the time. I didn't have any money left. So, and I'd been for a job interview to be like a deputy CEO of a charity. I got found to the last two and I didn't get it. So I was like, oh my God, how is this, you know, what's ahead for me? What's the next month? I don't know what I'm going to do. So this changed so many things in so many ways. And yeah, life certainly got a lot easier after that. So it was not the same as a VC. I didn't even know what one was at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's super crazy. So, I mean, this week in startups, Jason Calacanis.
Ah, Jason.
Yeah, so obviously the, you know, the godfather angel investing, I think, you know, for a lot of people. But again, I mean, some of the things that you just mentioned there really resonate. I think one of the things that I find very difficult for impact ventures that are going after grant funding is that there is a huge amount of, there are a lot of hurdles that you've got to jump over, a lot of hoops that you've got to jump through to even kind of qualify to be told whether or not you'd qualify for a grant, let alone actually receive the grant funding. And it strikes me that often the businesses or the sort of enterprises that might need to go after grant funding are probably or potentially the least well equipped, because they don't necessarily have a CFO in place or, you know, someone who can do those 3-year financials. So it's really interesting to me that even 10 years ago, that was still the process, that you had to provide all of that information up front before you'd even get a chance to kind of go in and then pitch for the funding. And the second thing, and I kind of was having a bit of a giggle on my side when you said this, it is in the 7 years I've been working with tech ventures, it seems to be a truism that anytime you're pitching, like if you're pitching a tech venture, the tech won't work. It just won't. Your laptop will die. You know, the presentation.
It was their fault. They were embarrassed. It was their screen wouldn't connect to my Mac. PCs, and I came in with a Mac and it dumbfounded everyone.
Well, this is it. You're ahead of your time again. First mover advantage. But look, things didn't get necessarily that much easier. But after exiting via an MBO, you actually bought the assets back a few years ago. So why did you decide to do that?
I mean, when we'd been, you know, I'd had VC backing after that, you know, I got angel and then VC backing over the next few years. And I decided to put a lot of my eggs in one direction, in the social care sector. So it evolved from B2C to B2B model. And I was selling across social care. And at that point, and still frankly, social care is significantly underfunded. But one thing really started to change the funding for me, because I was seen as an innovative product. We did have a lot of impact, but there's lots of other things in social care, that particularly staff, that the money has to be spent on. They changed the rules on overnight wage, hourly wages, and a lot of people had to pay back pay a lot of money. And some of these big social care ones had to back pay that accounted to millions. So all the innovation budgets were slashed. Anyone that was working in, you know, something like I was doing got hit. So everything kind of, the market went, and this can happen. This is what happens. You know, your product can be great, everything can be scrolling along, but the government changes something like that and it hits, you know, your main market. So it wasn't growing at the pace that it needed to. And so I was unable to arrange an MBO, and then eventually after a few years decided to buy it back, because it wasn't, I knew I could run it better than anyone else, and I had done that. And I knew also how to turn it into a model that was self-serving. So a lot of stuff had to be stripped out, had to remove from being B2B back to the B2C. And also it needed more investment. So I needed to put my own money into it again and rebuild it. So that's what's happened. So it's been, you know, the last few years have been rebuilding and restructuring, but it's out there now and in its new form, My Choice Pad 2, very imaginatively named, but it still serves all those people and new ones because, you know, as society is, people are born or, you know, develop learning disabilities, lots of children, and they're still out there and they still need support with their communication. This is not going to go away. This needs to be around forever. So it's very important.
And if anything, I think the recognition that these learning disabilities exist and how prolific they actually are is becoming more and more, or it's been surfaced more and more over the last, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, maybe, let's say. But as you say, I think also as you start thinking about developing nations, which are now sort of, you know, getting onto that education ramp, you're going to see a much bigger sort of need for that. One of the things that you said there really strikes me as a massive problem for impact ventures, just as a quick aside, and that's around, you know, government changing tack, as you mentioned. So whether that's, you know, the NHS, whether that's the education system, whether that's, you know, social care, and a lot of impact ventures are highly dependent on working with often quite fragmented and sort of, you know, entities that are almost at odds with each other. And I think it takes a certain type of person to really have, you know, the chutzpah to get out there and work with government, because you know that oftentimes, you know, as you say, they may change tack, they may change their funding priorities, they may change their overall priorities. Mm-hmm. And actually, you've got to be able to pivot on a dime almost to make sure that you can carry on. And the other thing I think that is incredible is, as you say, yes, My Choice Pad 2, but a decade in and still going strong. So congratulations. Mm-hmm. I think that's amazing. So I wanted to now sort of pivot more towards your kind of investment, you know, funding journey. So clearly you've had a focus on impact from the start, but when it comes to investing, there can be a little bit of reluctance, especially from a number of VCs, to back something that looks like it's impact or social good. Why are they wrong in your opinion?
Wrong? Can you rephrase that?
Yeah. So I think a lot of VCs look at impact and say, you know, this won't provide the sort of returns that I'm looking for, that venture-backed businesses need to return. But there are a number of impact VC funds out there. And, you know, Ananda especially, I think, you know, looks at impact from a VC viewpoint first as much as the impact. So why do you think other venture firms are more reluctant to invest in impact ventures, given that they can, you know, produce the same sort of returns that, you know, traditional ventures do?
Yeah, well, I might disagree with you slightly there, because what I see is an increasing number of investors coming to us wanting to understand more about impact. The first step is everybody, you know, looking at ESG. We're all having to do that. Every single investor. This is, for me, is you know, putting a new direction. It's not impact, but it's the step towards impact. So they're taking that move. And then the more enlightened ones are going beyond that and looking at how they can become more impactful. It's just a question of emphasis. And so for us, it's great, it's bad. There's more competition. There's a lot more impact, you know, VCs out there, and more of the mainstream ones who hadn't traditionally been like that moving towards us. And we co-invest with many of them. So I think it's not seen like that anymore. And then for those that would argue against me, there are, you know, there's lots of very pure fintech plays out there that won't look at, or ones that do consumer goods that are encouraging us to buy more things that we don't need. I think, you know, society will go against them at some point. Maybe their day's still here at the moment, but if the long term, and VC is a long term game, they're in the wrong direction. So what I would say, though, is that the money and where it comes from, so the LPs or the investors in the VC firms, they are the ones who have the ability to drive the direction. And what we're seeing now, I mean, everyone's being held accountable with all the ESG. So we're all having to get good at implementing and having due diligence and looking after our portfolio and reporting on ESG. There are more pension funds wanting more impactful investments, and the retail markets, so when we go to IPO, there's a lot more wanting ESG related, which essentially is impact at that level, stock. So this drive is coming now and it's finally changing. So there's more LPs and there's more family offices wanting a section of their money to go into this space. There will always be those that don't care. I think it's getting less though, and it's definitely driving in this direction. But those who don't care obviously are just very driven by the numbers. And there's an increasing amount now who still that are prepared to say, okay, we'll drop a little bit on the numbers if you can promise me that you'll get some return that fulfill my ESG criteria that I need to do to my, you know, stakeholders from the pension funds. This is what everyone's demanding. So it's changing. It's going to take some time. I think we'll see in another 10 years, it will be quite substantially different, but it's already evolving.
I think that's super interesting. I think to your point, LPs drive that agenda to a large extent. And as you say, you know, the pension funds or maybe it's family offices who have that concern around impact and ESG are going to drive some of that, the investment behavior from VCs. Equally, I think, you know, it's interesting your point around those that are just chasing those consumer apps. We're seeing, you know, we've just seen some consolidation in the fast grocery space. There's going to be more consolidation, you know, because ultimately I ask myself this question all the time. How much more can we consume sustainably? It feels to me like these are the wrong battles to be picking. And yes, there may be immense markets and yes, there may be money to be made, but maybe I'm slightly, you know, looking at it from the wrong angle. But if venture is about anything, it's about creating change for the future, and it feels to me like consumerism is not change for the future, it's just monetizing the present.
Yeah, acting as a catalyst for change and adding value comes in many forms, not just the financial.
Absolutely. So you spent a couple of years as a venture partner at Ananda before joining as principal. And there seems to be a lot of kind of proliferation of these sort of roles, whether that's venture partner or scouts in the ecosystem. What value does that bring to the fund and to, you know, venture in general?
Yeah, I would say that I think it's in the last 3 or 4 years that we've seen a proliferation, haven't we? There didn't used to be that many. So I know when they asked me to be a venture partner, I had to look up what one was. I didn't know any and there weren't that many around. They seemed to be people who'd worked in VC and then decided to step away from the day to day. Or they were entrepreneurs, which I guess is the role that I play, being an entrepreneur, having a good ecosystem. And my purpose was to provide deal flow, so sourcing, and to help and assist with the portfolio in the areas of my specialty, so social care, healthcare, and ed tech. But every venture partner has its different roles and what they do and how much they're involved. It's very much a personal relationship with the firm that you're working for as to how much. But I've seen quite a proliferation recently of many new firms having a lot more venture partners than full-time staff. I guess they're using them for sourcing and for the board. I don't think there's any rules anymore. You used to have a lot of staff and then just a couple of venture partners. I think you can, you know, it's good to see it the other way so that you can focus on the day-to-day and get the deals done and not so much more on the sourcing. Fine, if that works for you, that's how your company's set up. The scouts, I mean, I have a scouting role too when it comes to female founders in clean tech. But this, every scout system has its different purposes. I mean, this one is the fact that, you know, I'm well connected to the female founder network, and I know a lot of other female investors. So from the fact of my network, I can attract and bring people into the early stage, you know, clean tech investors. There aren't so many female founders. So it's about getting into all these different communities to find and bring them to the right people. So that has its purpose on its own. And it would be the same of any, you know, founders, any people working where they're serving people from underserved communities. You need the Scout Network to get into those communities. I'm not paid for that, but this is part of what you do. And I know there's a lot of other ones that do pay, and there's a percentage that you get on the, you know, on the carry. God knows how long that takes for you to receive that. So I wouldn't want to be doing that and relying on it for a source of income, because that could take 10 years to come through. But for me, I don't see anything bad. I think what founders need to be aware of is when someone is a scout, it's not going to be their full-time job to be doing that, and that they will hand you over to someone else, you know. And that could be the same with some venture partners too. All venture partners aren't the same. They could, you know, initially source you, have the first interview, and then they will pass you over. It doesn't necessarily mean they have a lot of influence, but some other venture partners do have a lot of influence, and they'll sit on the investment committee, or they'll advise the investment committee. So I guess do your research, and maybe that's one of the first questions that you ask subtly. What is their role and how do they work within, you know, that organization?
Yeah, I think that's spot on, because even having looked at various sort of resources, the way one firm defines a venture partner versus another can be quite different. In fact, you know, often venture partner and scout are used interchangeably or differently from firm to firm. And I think it is super important, both as, you know, as a founder, if you are going out looking for investment, to understand who you're talking to at all times. It doesn't matter whether it's a venture partner or an associate at a fund. You want to make sure that you are very, very, you know, you have understood very well what decision-making capacity they have and capability they have. But I think, to your point, it's about decentralizing that deal flow, making sure that, yes, you can touch communities which otherwise you wouldn't necessarily have had access to, whether that's, you know, minority ethnic, or whether that's gender related, whether that's age related, right? So I know a couple of funds that, you know, they make sure that they have some Gen Zers on their books, because otherwise how are they going to know what's happening in the Gen Z market? In my circumstances, I use my daughters as my bell, you know, my bellwether as to what's going on there. So let's talk about Ananda itself. So how do you define impact at the fund, and what beyond that does a venture need to have to be considered to be investable? Is it team traction? Is it tech? Or is it something else altogether?
Okay, so yeah, Ananda, the way it defines impact is it's baked into the business model. So it's not an add-on. So you buy one pair of shoes and one pair of shoes gets donated to somebody, you know, in an undeveloped country. It's so the more you sell, the more impact you have. So in the case of digital healthcare, if you're working on something, you know, that helps with Parkinson's, then the more of the items that you sell, the more impact you're having. It's quite simple like that. And then within that, we look at a theory of change. So this is a statement around what you're doing in the short, medium and long term to get to your eventual outcome. So if you've done project management, you'll understand the differences between outputs and outcomes. So outputs are the things that go along the way. These can be KPI driven. And the outcomes are the eventual change that basically defines your whole mission and what you're trying to do as a founder. So that might be to improve, you know, someone's healthcare. It might be to improve someone's experience in healthcare, or somebody's educational attainment. Standards of life, basically, and there's qualities that you could do that in healthcare, and also with the environment, you know, how much CO2 reduction, how much water are you saving, you know, just all the different ways that you can apply this and look at it. And in terms of the level of the impact that we're looking for with this latest fund, so Ananda started out with its first fund was 8 million, and the fund I was involved in, it was 22. When you're looking at those levels and the returns that are required, it's quite substantially different now. Those were much smaller funds. You could invest in things that have, you know, lower outcomes in terms of financial returns. Like mine was in assistive technology. That's a really difficult market, but it was a fit for that fund. Our fund then was 50 million and now it's 100 million. So the kind of returns we're looking for, they have to be industry wide. So for us to have the level of impact and to sell to us, whatever it is that you're doing, you must have in your head a strong narrative over where you're playing now and why this is the best beachhead market to then move into all the other sectors within the industry and how that could look. And I need to be able to feel I understand that. And if I don't, and if I don't get it really quite quickly in the first one or two conversations, then I'm not going to think it's a big enough market. No matter how much SOM that you give me, it's not going to work. I need to feel how that market is going to piece together and whether I think that industry is going to move in the next 5 to 7 years or maybe even earlier. And that's when, you know, we can strike, and that's what works in VC at that level. So our ticket size is 1 to 3 million, and we need to look to basically get 50 million out of every single one that we put in. So that means essentially your exit valuation needs to be between $500 million and $1 billion. So if you think about it like that, that's where I am coming from. So the impact that you're having, it's the narrative, where you're going and what area, which is why we tend to be B2B, because it pieces together a lot more. That doesn't mean that you don't have to start out like that. It could be B2C at the beginning, and then by the time we invest, it becomes B2B as you've grown. You need to have the story on how that merges together and why this market is going to do that. What's changing? Can't be just regulation, that we can't rely on that one. Everyone says that one, but you've got no control over it. What else is the market forces that are happening that give us an indicator that this is going to all move together at some point very close in the future? So it's quite a hard task, I think, is what I'm describing. I know when I was invested in, I never had to sell that, but it was a much smaller fund. So it's really important as a founder that you understand the size of the fund that you're dealing with, because they will have quite different expectations. And in some ways, having this 100 million fund, everyone goes, ooh, 100 million, you know, eyes perk up, nice number, making it quite more difficult. There's lots of things we can't invest in anymore that still would have significant impact. They're just not the right kind of company for us anymore with this size of fund.
They're not going to be able to provide the returns. They're not going to be able to return the fund, which ultimately, like all VCs, and this kind of harks back to the earlier points we made, you know, at the end of the day, VC is about returning funds, right? No VC does it purely for philanthropic purposes, and that's why other entities exist. And to your point, as fund size grows, that return dynamic becomes that much harder. And I think this is a lesson for a lot of founders that they need to get, you know, they struggle to wrap their heads around, because, you know, I was asked recently on LinkedIn, well, what's the problem with having, you know, 10, $100 million firms, you know, within your portfolio? And I sort of walked that person through portfolio return sort of maths. And at the end of it, they were like, oh, okay, that makes sense now. But I think for a lot of founders, they just assume that, well, okay, if I can have a good enough outcome, that should be good enough for the VC fund. But actually, until you understand how venture fund maths and returns work, you know, it kind of, unless you understand that, you will never understand whether your business is going to be right for venture or not.
Yeah, and I'm always applauding the smaller funds, you know, the 10s, the 20s and the 30 million ones. They have such a crucial role in it all. We could not all be 100 million. Nothing would ever, you know, there's so many. You've got to build the smaller companies so the entrepreneurs can have their exits, you know, in maybe a quicker time than some of these larger ones that we invest in now. And then they recycle their money, becoming angel investors or serial entrepreneurs. And then maybe they go for the bigger industry-wide one that I can invest in. So the whole ecosystem needs to work. So I'm always like, yes, great. A 10 million fund, fantastic. Whereas I know some of the founders might go, that's a bit small. They actually have such an important role in everything that we do. We need those smaller ones. So we need more angels, we need more family offices putting into those smaller ones, because the institutions won't do them. The ticket, they normally have to be 30 million or above their ticket sizes. So it's just the balance is really required.
I think I was talking to someone recently, and even so the British Business Bank, which obviously cornerstones a lot of funds, like it needs funds to be over 30 million for them to be able to even come in. It's just not worth it at the lower levels. So therefore, those sort of funds are more reliant on, you know, LPs from family offices or ultra high net worths, because those are the people that can deploy the smaller checks, but still big checks in the grand scheme of things. Beyond Ananda, you're involved in myriad activities, right? So you founded Future World VC, you're on the panel of the EIC Accelerator, and you sat on the investment committee of Unlimited. So all entities that keep that thread of impact running through your activities. What change, or to use your vocabulary, what outcomes are you ultimately hoping to drive?
I think the main thing that underneath everything, obviously there's an impact thing, but social mobility. To everybody has their thing, and that's mine. So with the journey that I've come on from free school meals and single parent to where I am now in this privileged position as an impact investor, I'd like to see more people like me, you know, from the similar backgrounds to where I've come from. I think the innovation and the approach to risk and just there are life experiences when you come from somewhere where you've had to fight for everything that you've got, sets you up really well to be leader, to be a leader, whether it's of your own company, to be a leader in the venture world, to be a leader in government. And there's not enough of us. So I want to change that. And if that, you know, is the thing that I leave behind when I leave this planet on a rocket ship, hopefully. But I'd like to see that more equality in that area. That's something that's really important to me.
I think you and I will no doubt have an additional conversation about this, because I'd love to explain to you what Alex McDonald and I are doing with the Untapped Prize. But things have probably changed a huge amount in tech and venture over the last 10 years since you first sort of set up My Choice Pad. To wrap things up, like from your perspective, what's gone well and what could go better?
Has changed. I mean, I think what's gone well is I was really, really well supported by government programs really early on. I don't think you realize until you step outside of the UK how much the UK government does for tech. And I know we're always comparing ourselves to the US and we're not big enough. But if you just step into Europe and you talk about all the investment incentives, the SEIS and the EIS scheme, the ESOPs and the way that we treat all that, it's in Europe, it is not like that at all. The ecosystem here, it's so much healthier. And that's why, you know, with the social mobility, I think we do have a chance. There is this opportunity here. It's quite different in Europe. The rich stay rich. I mean, they do to an extent here, but there's so much more encouragement for wealth distribution here, redistribution. So I think the government, I mean, the lottery fund, which I know is gambling in some ways, but that's where the money from Unlimited came from for Big Venture Challenge. And then I've been on so many other support programs, you know, by the Cabinet Office, essentially putting money into accelerators. And they encouraged a lot of money by the match grant funding as well into the ecosystem, whether that was impact or otherwise. So I think, you know, we've got a really good setup here. The government, although it was always room for improvement, done incredibly well over the last 10 years. And I don't think anybody talks about that enough. I think we have to, you know, appreciate them in some respects and still give them hell on many other things. So that works. The setup here is really well, and it's really easy to set up a business as well. And the skills, we still need a lot more people coming in from outside the UK. That needs to improve. It's very sad what's happened with Brexit and the skills shortage that we're seeing now for many reasons, but that's one of the main ones. And we need to get that back, because I know 10 years ago, building my startup and recruiting, my company was 80% overseas. We didn't have many English born. And I really liked it like that. It was very mixed. It was diverse and it was fun. And it was learned, you know, great to be amongst all people from so many different backgrounds, but particularly from across Europe. There's so much talent out there. So I'd like to see that change. There is more money around, which is great. There's so much support systems. There's lots of mentoring. You never go short of a mentor. And there's plenty of that happening now. And that wasn't happening too much 10 years ago. We've still got work to do on the distribution of capital, which is what I was saying around social mobility, which covers many areas of underserved communities. But there's lots of work and there's initiatives on that. And with people like myself and you as well, and many others getting, you know, in the space, we're getting louder and change is starting to happen. And the LPs, the ones who put the money into us, are starting to measure us on these outcomes as well. How diverse is, you know, the money, where it's going into what kinds of founders, and starting to care about that and to want those. And I think when we were raising this fund, this fourth fund, it's the first time we've been asked so many questions in that area. And it wasn't just from the UK. UK has always been pretty strong on that. Europe is catching up too. And that's really, really good to see. So I think we're on the, sorry, it's all a bit positive, cusp of change. I'm a natural optimist. I have to be. That's why I do what I do. There's still many things that need to improve, but I feel I'm in a spot where I can feel it happening. And that's really important to me. If I felt I was on the outside, not that I have control over any of it, but I can influence and I can play a role. And that gives me hope. And well, more than hope, I'm going to make it change.
I love optimism. Thank you so much. I mean, that I think it's so wonderful to be able to finish off on a positive note. So Zoe, I'd really love to thank you for joining me here today. For our listeners, where can they find you? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Where can they look for you?
Yeah, Twitter, Zoe Pedden. So Zoe Pedden. And then you can find me on LinkedIn too. And you can just, if you want to submit your company, go through Ananda. I think it's info@ananda.vc.
Amazing. Thank you so much. So I really appreciate your time with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?